I'm Greg Johnson. Welcome to Countercurrents Radio. I'm joined today by David Yorkshire, the editor of Mjolnir Magazine, and John Morgan, who's the editor-in-chief at Arctos Media. Gentlemen, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thank you very much.
I want to talk today with both John and David about the importance of arts and culture in what we call metapolitics. One of the terms for metapolitics that Jonathan Bowden liked to use was cultural struggle, as opposed to just mere political struggle. So what I'd like to do is begin with David, because you are the editor of a very important magazine, Mjolnir, which is dedicated to this very topic. So David, can you tell us a bit about yourself, where you were born, your education, how you became a thought criminal, and so forth?
Well, I've always been a thought criminal from the very beginning. I grew up in a very traditionalist family, mm-hmm. So I'm a very old Yorkshire traditional family. And, you know, probably everyone in that family is racialist and believes in racialist ideas. And these were normative, but also normative for a reason, because, of course, if you're not secure in your racial identity, then you will obviously no longer be you. Racial ideas are incredibly important, and that is perfectly natural. And what the left seek to do is undo that natural kind of that natural way of looking at the world, in all its forms as well, not just racially, but we've seen kind of the attack on gender norms and things like that as well as. So, in my family, we had very kind of traditionalist gender norms, but that is not to say that, you know, women kind of were stuck behind a sink or something like that. That is, again, a fiction exaggeration created by the left. Actually, you know, everyone kind of pulled together in the household and things, you know, when something needed doing, it got done one way or another. One thing, when I was at school, I came to realize that my teachers were kind of anti-traditionalist, and that the stuff that we were being sold, I mentioned in a recent speech that we were given texts, especially in literature, like To Kill a Mockingbird by Harper Lee, so it could talk about the struggles of the blacks, you know, in America and things like that. And, there was a series called Shoah in the 1980s, which we were forced to watch, so it could talk about the oppression of the Jews and so on. And it occurred to me that, you know, that we were kind of being indoctrinated in something. And at about the age of around 14, I sort of rejected mainstream education. When I was 15, I sort of had a brief phase of getting into National Socialism. And through the aesthetics, I read Mein Kampf. I wasn't particularly enamored by it. And actually, you know, I kind of got more into medieval history and things like that. And really sort of realized that when I looked at the First Reich, the Second and the Third, so in other words, the Holy Roman Empire, the unified Germany after 1871, and then, the National Socialist regime, all I could see was decline. Mm-hmm. So, it was only a very brief phase. I think, everyone on the right sort of goes through it. But, you know, this led me on to kind of more traditionalist ideas and things like that. Now, when, you know, I finished school and I didn't go to university, I was completely fed up with the education system. And I went out and worked for 10 years. And then I went back into education and into university, and it was really to sort of fulfill an ambition that I had. I wanted to do something in education, and wanted to kind of get back some of these ideas, and But ultimately, you know, I quickly discovered that it would be all but impossible because the university institutions guard their left-wing dogma very jealously. Mm-hmm. They don't allow for any or at least much dissent. But nonetheless, you know, I have made slight inroads as a mainstream academic, bringing back people who they try to bury, you know, so kind of people who, like, for example, I gave a lecture, an academic lecture on Thomas Carlyle, who's a bit of a philosophical hero of mine. And, you know, and the paper, you know, is being published on that. So, you know, you can, if you kind of portray yourself as almost an ultra-conservative or something like that, some of them will sort of semi-accept you. But there is a line, and I've, you know, I've crossed that line, you know, straight over too far once already, and sort of was gotten rid of from, you know, from one academic institution. So it is difficult, but I also think that it is at least well worth doing. Certainly, bringing back some of the past canon into mainstream discourse. And with Mjolnir, you'll notice I always have a blast from the past. So mm-hmm. someone who has perhaps been forgotten about, or some of the work that is perhaps obscure or something like that, but who, you know, who's been buried really by the left because of their ideological viewpoints. The Mjolnir project is something that I find important, because just as they tried to bury the right-wing authors and you know, luminaries of the past, equally, you know, they're trying to stifle and trying to cut off any kind of outlet for today's right-wing writers and artists and so on. So I wanted to create an outlet for that. And that led me to the production of the magazine.
So tell us a little bit about the history of the magazine and how it's going so far and its reception.
Well, it was very difficult to begin with, actually, because to sort of, you know, get it known. But I had help along the way, and good help, actually. One of the people who came on board was Nick Walsh, who's the treasurer of the National Front, the political party in Great Britain. So people knew it from meetings of the National Front and things like that. The printer is a prominent member of UKIP. I'm not going to go into who that is or anything, because his position would be very precarious. But equally, you know, that kind of creates a link between the sort of semi-moderate right and what's called the extreme right by the mm-hmm. By the press, which is a good thing as well. So it got well known that way. And also, of course, you know, good people like you have promoted it. Kevin MacDonald on the Occidental Observer, he's promoted. Colin Liddell, of course, the alternative right, he's promoted it, and that's been great. You know, I'm very, very thankful for that. So, you know, it is slowly building momentum. More and more people are hearing of it. The first magazine, you know, didn't do so well. But then when the second magazine came out, and that was boosted by the presence of Charles Craft, of course, in the magazine, mm-hmm. then it took off. And also, people then discovered the first magazine and then ordered that.
Right.
And so it really took off from there, and, and is now kind of a success. And hopefully it will continue to build as we go along. Certainly, I think that... as regards the production quality, I think we're getting better and better on that as time goes on.
Mm-hmm.
But that's been a learning experience, obviously. You know, you make all the mistakes it's possible to make with, you know, the first time round, but then learn for the next one and so on.
Right. So let's bring John into this discussion too. I want to ask both of you who you think are the most significant contemporary artists of the right, so to speak. John, do you want to go first? And then we'll go to David.
Yeah, sure. Well, do you mean writers in the mainstream who I think have some relevancy for the right, or more, you know, people who are active on the right?
Well, how about both?
Okay. Well, as far as, you know, our circles go, you know, for me, there's no question that the most important writer would be Tito Perdue. Mm-hmm. I mean, he got in touch with Arctos a few years ago because he wanted us to publish some of his stuff. And I had never heard of him before, I have to say, and I didn't know who he was. And then I went and looked him up and realized that he, you know, had already had... I would say a successful literary career, kind of on the margins. Although he was, his first book, Lee, was positively reviewed in the New York Times back in, I think it was 1991, mm-hmm. when it first appeared. I just think his stuff is amazing. I definitely think he's one of the most important American writers today, and the fact that he's been willing to sort of come over to our side and work with us, I think, is. Is a great boon for us. So yeah, he would definitely be the most important. In terms of mainstream writers, who I think are good, I would say, you know, from our perspective, I would say Cormac McCarthy. He tends to be a bit of a nihilist, but I get the impression from him that he's still writing in sort of the great novel tradition. Mm-hmm. Of the West, and you know, I don't discern a whole lot of political correctness in his books. Don DeLillo would be another novelist who I think is quite relevant, and also I definitely wouldn't call him of the right, but in terms of important authors, I would say that Paul Auster, even though he's kind of a darling of postmodern literary critics, he's kind of ignored in the U.S., but he's very popular here in Europe. I never go in a bookshop anywhere where they don't have a whole shelf of his books out. And I think the reason is that if you really look at what he's saying in his work, he's kind of revealing the fact that in modern day America, and I think we could say this of the West more generally, there is no real identity anymore. You know, his first, well, not his first book, but his most famous book is City of Glass, which is essentially the story of a character who goes insane through the realization that he has no real identity. City of Glass, also referring to New York City. There's some people, not, you know, you couldn't really be explicitly of the right, even less of the radical right, and make it in mainstream literary circles today, which is why publications like Mjolnir are so important. I think we need to be creating places for contemporary artists and writers to present their work, where they don't have to worry about harassment. But certainly there are some people working in the mainstream who have things that are relevant for us, I would say. But James Ellroy, too, he's doesn't seem to be doing much these days, but I saw him speak once, and he's definitely of the right, although I would say more the, you know, in the American style of conservatism. But right. He was quite unapologetically rightist when I saw him speak. It was in Ann Arbor, Michigan, where I was living at the time. He was quite deliberately baiting the audience a number of times.
Interesting.
By saying very politically incorrect things.
So, David, who are some of your favorites, your current favorites?
Well, as you know, as John's kind of concentrated on the literacy, you know, I'll sort of concentrate more on the visual arts. So Charles Kraft is the obvious one. Mm-hmm. especially as his technique is so good. He's both a great technician, which is the true mark of a great artist, and produces things that are important and new and novel. Mm-hmm. As well, he's got, I noticed, someone doing kind of painted pastiches. You'll have to ask Charles about that. I've forgotten the name of the guy, but he's actually, he's kind of doing copies of Charles Kraft, but painted rather, in paintings rather than porcelain, which is it's a bit of a cheap kind of copy, but mm-hmm. But equally it's a form of flattery as right. well, because once you start being pastiche and copied and everything, it really means that other people find you important. Vic Schulman is another one, the Dutch sculptor. Right. He's in the current issue actually, and he again is someone who is very well trained, knows his craft, creates bronze reliefs, mm-hmm. but also does paintings as well. He's currently doing a new painting for the cover of the fourth issue, which will be out in the summer. So that's something I'm looking forward to as well. To have Vig as a sort of a recurring artist in there, because I do think that he's exceptional. Also, the good thing about Vig is that he brings back a sort of spiritual aspect to the arts as well. If we look at the left and their art, it is entirely materialistic, mm-hmm. because of course the left negate the spirit in all its forms, and I think that we have to concentrate on that, on metaphysics and spirituality and that kind of thing, but equally not divorce it from racialist ideas.
Mm-hmm.
The problem with me, for example, with someone like Julius Evola, is that he divides race into three categories: the race of the mind, the race of the spirit, and the race of biology. But that, to me, you can't divide that, because if you divide that, that would presuppose that one can contradict the other. Well, they can't, and so these three things are bound together. And so they're not separate at all, and that is a fundamental flaw in the philosophy of Evola for me. The one thing cannot contradict the other, because if the one contradicts the other, something, one of them must be false. But so really the importance of Schulman's is that racialist and spiritualist ideas come together in his artwork. The last one I'd like to mention is Ted Stedman, who created the front cover of issue 3. It's quite an old painting of his. He kind of abandoned pretty much his artwork and his politics as well for mm-hmm. quite some time, and he's just got back into things as part of Mjolnir, that kind of got him back into things, and he was at the London Forum mm-hmm. Recently, and he created the front cover of Michael Walker's Return of Ulysses.
Okay.
Yeah, as an addition to John's talk on the contemporary literature, I think that Michael Walker is important as well. Certainly the play The Return of Ulysses is very good, and I recommend people read it, because the themes that are in Homer's story in any case are extraordinarily relevant today. And that is brought out in Walker's play. Although, as he says, it is primarily art and not propaganda. And that is something I always look at for Mjolnir magazine. It has to be good, first and foremost, as art.
Right. There are a couple people I'd add to the list so far. Leo Yankevich, the poet, I'm very, very fond of. I also think Jean Raspail, who hasn't been writing for years, but still he's alive, he's still with us, is really a first-rate author. And I think, objectively, Welbeck really is a man of the right.
Yeah. Yes, too. I hadn't thought of him.
Yeah, he's very impressive. And there are a number of other people that I've published at Countercurrents, like Julie Hobson or...
Oh, yes, I forgot to mention her, yes.
Andy Nowicki. There's some really good satirists that we have... also published, like Joseph Salemi and Sally Cook, and also Jeff Costello with his Heidegger in Chicago novel. So there's a lot that's really going on the contemporary scene.
Yeah. If I can just add, Julie Hobson, should have mentioned her. Apologize to Julie there. Yeah, we've had a continued association with Julie Howard Hobson. I regard her as the best living poet, and not just because she's one of ours. But equally, you talked about authors who are still living but haven't published for a long time. One that has been neglected is David Story, who's from Leeds in Yorkshire. Now, he kind of came off the back of the Angry Young Men movement. His first novel was The Sporting Life in 1960. And he is certainly on the kind of fringes of, between the right and the radical right.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly he was influenced by Wyndham Lewis.
Mm-hmm.
He was interviewed and said point blank that she was an artist before he was a writer, actually. So just like Lewis kind of transcended the two mediums.
Right.
And, he hasn't been published since the 1990s, but there are some, extremely radical ideas in there and very rightist ideas, particularly in present times, for example, where he has a character who is quite obviously Jewish, and seem to be behind, some of the kind of goings on in the change in society, and not for the better. So that is, he's one person I recommend people read. And as I say, he was once a very mainstream writer as well. This Sporting Life was made into a film with Richard Harris.
Okay. Well, I had not heard of him. I've jotted this down for future reference.
You mentioned that he was affiliated with the Angry Young Men, so he must have known Bill Hopkins and...
Not really affiliated. As I say, he came off the back of the Angry Young Men movement.
Okay.
So in other words, he wasn't one of them. It was too late to be really one of them. But he sort of wrote in that kind of genre, the sort of struggle of Northern working class people and so on, but from the right, not from the left.
Mm-hmm.
One
of the problems that I wrestle with is how one can encourage new artists.
Yes.
Because we really do want to have a vital rightist artistic culture, such as what existed between the wars, for instance, when there are a tremendous number of important figures, Nobel laureates, and highly creative individuals. And one thing we can do is offer an outlet as publishers. Another thing we can do, I think, is offer criticism, literary criticism, to people who are around, coming up and offering things to the public. And then a third thing is to uphold certain examples from the past and help rediscover important people from the past who might inspire people today. Who do you think are some of the more important figures from the past that really should be rediscovered and who might actually inspire artistic creativity?
I think the big one, at least philosophically, has to be Thomas Carlyle, because it is difficult to imagine Victorian literature without him, because he shaped it to such a degree. You know, for example, Dickens was a disciple of his, who is the great author of the 19th century in England.
Right.
Dickens dedicates A Tale of Two Cities to Carlyle, because, of course, Carlyle wrote a very famous study of the French Revolution. But not just Dickens, he influenced Alfred Lord Tennyson, who was the poet laureate, and he influenced John Ruskin, who influenced the Pre-Raphaelite Brotherhood. So his influence is extraordinary, and not just of his own time, but afterwards as well. So, for example, Yeats read Carlyle, who influenced the Blue Shirts. And there was a very famous, as I told you yesterday, there's a very famous paper written in 1945 by a Jewish academic called Shapiro, called Carlyle, the Prophet of Fascism. And that really kind of destroyed his reputation. It didn't help, of course, that one of the last books Hitler read in his bunker was by Carlyle. But
which one was that?
I can't remember which one it is.
It was his biography of Frederick the Great.
That's right, it is. Yes, that's right. And so, you can see how a man's reputation might be affected by this. But Carlyle wasn't really, I don't think, a fascist. He was a neo-feudalist, if I was to call him anything. And because he had very aristocratic ideas, but aristocracy in a Platonic sense, you know, the rule of the best, an aristocracy of talent, as he called it. So not necessarily hereditary. In fact, he was quite against the hereditary principle. That is interesting, actually, because then you can sort of compare him to Evola, who's very in favour of the hereditary principle. I personally think that they're kind of the two extreme ends, and the truth lies in the middle. That if, for example, you always think that the father will follow the son, and so on,
right.
But obviously sometimes the apple falls far from the tree.
Right.
Sometimes I think that it would be a logical progression, but if things prove to be otherwise, then you need to change the person at the head of the aristocracy or the aristocrat or whatever, and give someone more deserving a chance. So that's really Carlyle. He sort of invented the Fuhrer principle as well, almost in his lectures on heroes and hero worship.
Right.
I think that they're very important, especially the analysis of the king figure, the king as ableman, and also as kinsman. So, the organic idea of an aristocratic system. And it's very interesting in Carlyle that he always appeals to nature as his moral basis. That which is natural is good. So that I think is a sound moral foundation to build the right upon. And so I think that he's probably one of the most underrated and also neglected philosophers that really needs to be brought back as something to build a foundation for an artistic movement on, because artistic movements are often built upon philosophical ideas. And Carlyle as well, the other important thing is that he transcended philosophy and literature,
mm-hmm.
especially in, for example, Sartre, Resartus, the you know his early novel, but equally his philosophical papers are written not in the conventional academic style, but in a romantic style that is in part prose poetry. And there is a distinct aesthetic to it, whereby the aesthetic is just as important as the meaning.
Mm-hmm.
And that is, you know, ultimately a very artistic sensibility. So I think that Carlyle is something that we have to look at more, and also the people he influenced, of course, Dickens. Tennyson, for me, is one of the great poets, and also Goethe. Now, interestingly, Goethe and Carlyle had a correspondence when Carlyle was a very young man,
mm-hmm.
and Goethe mentored him through correspondence, and he brought German idealism for an English audience.
Are there other figures that you think need to be rediscovered?
Yes, I mean, I'm slowly kind of adding them, to the blast from the past in Mjolnir. The next one will be Thomas Inglesby, who's been rather forgotten,
mm-hmm.
who created the Inglesby legends. It's interesting because he was a reverend, a member of the Anglican clergy,
mm-hmm.
but also very interested in kind of folk tale and the retelling of folk tale, to kind of take a folk tale and adapt it into a short story. And I think that is very interesting, actually, and something that people should look at for inspiration, that folk tale can be adapted into short stories quite easily. And that is something that he did well. He said of himself that he could never think of an original idea. But what he did well was to create a great story from an old folk tale and make it into humorous, or because he had a very good sense of humor as well. I think that's very interesting as well, to sort of look at the Anglican Church of back then when he was writing in the 19th century. He was another one who knew Dickens personally.
Mm-hmm.
And where was I? I've lost my thread now. But the main thing is on Anglicanism, the difference between Anglicanism then and Anglicanism now. Now, you know, I'm personally a pagan. It doesn't really sort of float my boat or anything. But there are a lot of kind of Christians, old traditionalist Christians in the movement, especially Americans,
mm.
who tend, I've noticed, to come from a Calvinist background, which Carlyle did, of course, but pretty much became a pagan. But equally, he didn't want to tear down Christianity, not like Nietzsche. He actually wanted, a hardcore belief in it, but a robust belief, not in the kind of sort of liberal ideas that Christianity espouses now, but more militant, more kind of... He has a lot of time for Islam, actually, but because he likes the militancy of Islam, but doesn't believe that Islam has a place, for us, because it's not our way of thinking. What he wants to see is a militant Christianity. Now, we've got a problem at the moment between sort of the pagans and the Christians and their kind of don't really like each other very much, and you know, and each you get these squabbles on Facebook and on the
right.
various websites and everything. I personally, but you know, I'm kind of a live and let live kind of guy, so you know, I will have people from Christian backgrounds in Mjolnir, providing that you know that they believe in racialist and cultural, you know, and
right.
Eurocentric ideas. I have nothing against them, and I think that it's a diversion from the real issues that we face.
So, do you deal with music or film?
Well, I interviewed Les Brigands in France recently.
Right.
And the interview, at least in part, the write-up from that is in the current issue. It's difficult, of course, to actually, you know, put music into a magazine.
Right.
it's,
right.
But equally, these things can be found very easily on YouTube,
right.
or something these days. So, but yeah, so certainly, you know, we mention music and things like that. We will discuss musicians because music is exceptionally important. Because you know, it cannot be underestimated how much the left have got their ideas into the mainstream through music and transformed the mainstream because of it.
Right. Definitely, you know, with popular music.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, and they haven't been so successful with classical music, so they've just sort of made the whole genre boring and esoteric, so it doesn't have any broader cultural power anymore. It's certainly gone are the days when a Verdi could write an opera that could rally a nation.
You know? Yeah, that's right.
That's gone. But
yeah, because
now there'd be a music video.
Right.
Yeah, because they're deeply anti-traditionalist, of course. And so one of the big attacks they've had is on classical music, on opera and everything. Well, what they do to Wagner, of course, is they'll attack the music through the aesthetics.
Right.
To the point where it's actually distracting from the music.
Exactly, yeah.
You know, or makes the story unintelligible.
Yes.
Yeah. It's like almost that there's the scene in A Clockwork Orange where, you know, where they're kind of re-educating young Alex.
Yes.
And they're playing him, you know, his favorite Beethoven while he's watching all these dreadful things on the television. Yeah. You know, on the big screen or whatever.
Yeah.
And it is that kind of thing.
Right. Film is I think, one of the most important art forms. And I think that it better fits Wagner's definition of the complete work of art, even
yeah,
in opera.
Absolutely, yes.
They're not, unfortunately, it takes a great deal of capital and a large number of people to make films. Mm. And so we aren't really there yet. But do you still envision a place for film criticism and film theory within your project?
What I don't want it to become is a magazine that's, you know, that's full of criticism.
Right.
I want it to be primarily for the contemporary arts of now.
Right.
Because I think that, you know, you're doing that already with Countercurrents.
Right.
So there's not much point in, you know, in doing it again.
Yeah, and it's hard to print a film on paper.
That's true. Although,
do a graphic novel version of it or something.
Although one-act plays, you know, very
right.
doable.
Yeah.
There's one of mine in the current issue. So that is something to look at. You know, a shortened form of plays,
mm-hmm.
or sketches or whatever. But then people have to remember that they're writing as much for the printed word as for a live audience.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
So we touched on the topic of critics Who are some of your favorite critics or theorists of art who are generally rightist?
Who? That's a good one. I haven't thought about that. Well, certainly Eliot. T.S.
Eliot. I was just going to say,
I'll leave it to you, T.S. Eliot.
I mean, his. I was just telling Dave over lunch that, you know, I love reading his essays where he's critiquing things that I'm not even particularly interested in because they're just such wonderful to read stylistically. That's, you know, I just love reading them from that sense. But, you know, he's, you know, Eliot today, I think, would be regarded as a radical conservative. I mean, he very much was defending the Western tradition. And, you know, of course, in his own work, in his poetry with The Wasteland and The Hollow Men and so forth. I mean, he was undoubtedly a master artist himself, but also a great critic, which is a rare combination.
Yeah.
Not many people are both good critics and good artists, but he was both. So yeah, I would tell people they should definitely go and check his work out.
Yeah, I think for me the most interesting thing what he mentioned was the mythic method.
Mm-hmm.
You know, whereby contemporary short stories or novels or whatever contemporary art is underpinned by the mythic from the past, which you get in novels like Ulysses, which we were talking about earlier, which of course is based on Homer's Odyssey.
Yeah, I mean the modernists we were saying earlier, you know, were probably it was basically, you know, an explicitly rightist artistic movement, probably the last one that, you know, actually caught on in the mainstream. But all of the major figures of modernism, with the exception of Joyce, that who I can think of, were either explicitly or implicitly rightist in their outlook.
Yeah.
And the great thing about Eliot too is that, you know, he firmly defends the Western tradition in a way that, you know, today if you study literature in school, of course, it's all about, you know, well, it hasn't been, you know, completely abrogated yet, but the Western tradition is just seen as one of many, and of course, you know, we should be learning about all of them equally so we can become wonderfully multicultural. But you know, Eliot was somebody who, you know, if you read his essays, he very much believed in the Western tradition, and that, you know, we as Westerners should operate within that tradition, which of course means being familiar with everything that came before us and upholding its values and its styles. So that's another way. Colin Wilson, actually, in his later work, also, I mean, I wouldn't put him on the same level as Eliot, but he also very much defended, you know, operating within the Western tradition and upholding it as, you know, being the one that offers things that no other world tradition does in terms of literature and philosophy.
So I think another one that that perhaps deserves a mention is D.H. Lawrence.
Mm.
I think that his essays are interesting.
He hated American literature, though. Which
His essays on American literature are some of the most brilliant essays I've ever read, just stylistically. And I think what he says about Whitman is really impressive. But what's most profound, I think, are his essays on Melville, especially his Moby Dick essay.
Yeah.
That's really extraordinary.
Yeah. Although Moby Dick is, in any case, an extraordinary
the most important work of American literature, I would say.
For me, it's by far my favorite novel of all time. I find it extraordinary.
It really is the American myth, I would say.
Yeah.
Embodied in novel form.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Well, the American myth of the 19th century, not the American myth of the neocons.
Right. Let's say. So we broached the topic of modernism and the right, and many modernist literary figures were rightists, people like Hampson, D.H. Lawrence, Pound, Eliot, Wyndham Lewis. I could go on. Then there were visual artists, the Marinetti and the Futurist School were quite modernist, and of course Wyndham Lewis was also a modernist painter. One of the things, though, that the Third Reich really reacted strongly against was modernism in the arts. They tried to basically return sculpture to neoclassicism and painting to sort of 19th century academic painting styles. And recently there was an exhibition in New York City at the Neue Gallery on Antarctica Kunst. And it was very, very interesting. What they did is they had a number of paintings that were and sculptures that were decommissioned as decadent art by the Nazis. And they had a room with a number of Nazi-era paintings and sculptures, favored works, some of them quite famous. And then they had works by modernist artists who were, you know, ideologically pro-Nazi, but who were disfavored by the regime. And I went through there, and I kind of wanted to like the degenerate stuff. I wanted to give it a fair hearing, at least. You know, I thought maybe this stuff was really, you know, given a raw deal, but most of it was just dreadful. Yeah. It really was crap. It was degenerate and crappy. Some of it was brilliant stylistically, but it was generally awful. There are a few pieces that were of real worth.
Yeah. Isn't it Emil Nolde?
He
actually was a supporter of Hitler, but his work was banned, which I read. Yeah. He took very personally since he loved Hitler so much.
And there was a sculptor named Barlock that had the same fate, and I think there were one or two others there whose names escape me. Sadly, though, I thought that the regime-approved artwork was pretty insipid. Of course, they only had a few years to try and get things going again. But it was very clear to me that it was people like Nolde and Barlock and also people like Paul Klee. They had a number of Klees there that were really quite good. The trouble was that all the vitality in the arts was in modernism at the time. And you really had a choice, therefore, between degenerate modernism and healthy modernism. And it was really wonderful because right up the street at the Guggenheim at the same time was the biggest exhibition I think that's ever been put together since World War II of Italian futurist art.
I was just going to say, I think in many ways, I actually think the Italian fascists, even though they weren't as successful politically as the German National Socialists, they actually understood this better. I mean, they didn't try to return to an imagined past so much. They actually were trying to envision something kind of futuristic.
Yeah, the artistic policy that Mussolini had was basically laissez-faire. I mean, they weren't going to tolerate stuff that was really degenerate and culturally Marxist. But on the other hand, because Mussolini didn't really have strong artistic tastes like Hitler did, he sort of let the different artistic schools that were pro-fascist compete for patronage and government projects and things like that. And so you had some neoclassicism, which is good. You had the Novecento movement, you had Italian Art Deco, basically, and you had Futurism. And Futurism was tremendously dynamic. And going through that Futurist exhibit, it was aggressively modernist, but you can't say that it was decadent. You can't say it's degenerate art. You know, there's a vitality about it that was quite impressive. And I think, you know, decadence is a kind of physiological category in a way, too. I mean, it has to do, Antartum literally means like biological degeneration, right? Yeah. And so the opposite of decadence would be vitality in the arts. And I think there really was a vital modernism.
Yes. Yeah, that's true.
And rightist figures who were vitalist and nature-oriented were attracted to that as an outlet, as a form of expression.
That's probably why Pound ended up in Italy rather than in Germany.
Yeah, that and the weather.
Absolutely, yeah.
I mean, I think he loved the Italian climate, too, and the language. And,
Marinetti even once, one of his writings from the 30s, he disparagingly refers to neo-medievalist Germany.
Right.
But he was conscious of the differences between the Third Reich and fascist Italy.
Yeah.
I think it's interesting, actually, that, you know, a lot of pro-national socialists, people these days, you know, they point to Arno Breker and everything as being a great sculptor, which he was. But the Hitler pretty much cut off one of his arms, basically, because he was also a modernist as well as a classicist before the regime came to power. So he kind of cut part of him away almost. And that had a very stifling effect on the arts. I have actually, I was talking to John earlier, I have the catalogues from the great art exhibitions of Germany that were held in Munich every year.
Mm-hmm.
And you're absolutely right. You know, it's pretty staid stuff.
Yeah.
It's, for me, I don't see much vitality in it at all. And, you know, and I think, well, if that's the best artistically that was going on at that time, then something is very wrong.
I just think that the really talented people had sort of migrated out of these somewhat dead forms. And really the only great artist, I think, that was working during the Third Reich is probably Arno Breker. There were some other sculptors who were pretty good. I can't think of any really first-rate painters that were working in that context. I just can't. And when you think of literary figures, I can't think of that many great literary figures either. And the ones who were great, people like Gottfried Benn, well, they were sort of expressionists themselves.
Yeah, holdovers from pre-1933. Well, even, you know, a lot of people who consider themselves to be National Socialists today, you know, they'll hold up people like Ernst Jünger and Hans-Heinz Evers, and people like this, but they were actually banned in the Third Reich. I mean, they were supporters early on, but certainly they weren't later. So it's kind of a contradiction to
that's right.
See that they were actually in opposition to the regime, and at least culturally.
Or the regime. As time went on, things got more and more narrow ideologically. I think, and that was a problem.
One of the things
apparently that Goebbels tried to save Impressionism, Expressionism, but was unsuccessful. And I personally think that had a lot to do with Hitler's rejection from the Viennese Academy.
Probably, yeah.
But also, as well, the kind of theories of Alfred Rosenberg. For example, you know, he wrote against Jugendstil, which is, I mean, Jugendstil is marvelous to look at, you know, but he calls it effeminate, and, you know, the vision of art became ever narrower.
Right.
And that's not the way you should govern. You should allow, you know, quite a broad range. You don't kind of come down with a hammer. You sort of push people along with a soft hammer. You know, come on, you know.
Right.
And don't expect them to adhere strictly to a single ideology.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. As long as they're kind of pushing the mainstream along in a certain direction that is where you want it to be going, then you let them get on with it.
Right. You know. One of the things that the Third Reich really did excel in was graphic design and other sort of design concepts. And it's tremendously impressive if you look at even advertising and illustration. They're very, very good.
Yeah.
A friend of mine showed me an album full of telegraph forms, right? If you were sending a telegram to someone, you could pick the kind of stationery it would be printed on to deliver it. And it was just extraordinarily powerful and interesting designs for things as simple as telegrams. And so I do think that was one area that they did excel in. It's modernist in a certain way. There's a lot of vitality to it, a lot of starkness.
you get a lot of echoes of the kind of styles from France in the 1920s, actually.
Mm-hmm. There were some sort of streamline and Art Deco elements to it. I thought exactly. A lot of this design had. It's quite powerful and quite good. So, David, we're coming up on the 1 hour mark, and I know you've got a train to catch.
Yes,
so we should wrap this up. So let's first give you an opportunity to plug the magazine again and give a website or a Facebook page or just a way that anybody who wants to buy this magazine can buy it from you or get in touch with you if they want to submit something.
Yeah. By all means, we're always looking for new writers, artists, and so on. And, I hope that the magazine will inspire more people to get themselves into the creative arts, because the right has always been strongest in the creative arts rather than through theory. Theory is quite new for the right. We mentioned Carlyle earlier, but he's one of the few. Really, the bulk of theory has come from the left.
I would say in continental Europe there was quite a tradition.
Yes.
Going back to the French Revolution.
That's very true. Really talking about the Anglosphere, you're absolutely right. The French right has a long tradition that really starts with the Revolution, but probably also because of the Revolution more than anything. But in the Anglosphere, at least, the right has always kind of got its ideas through art. And although Ruskin was a theorist as well, but he's kind of pretty moderate. But although these days it would be regarded as quite ultra conservative in some ways, I think that really I would like to see more people getting involved in the creative movement, go to things like writers' workshops, writers' groups. In Britain we have them set up by the local education authorities. You can go to them on evenings and stuff like that, learn a bit of stuff. You can go to evening college and learn the techniques of painting and things like that. It's well worth doing. Why sit at home and watch television? There's nothing on it. There's nothing of any worth there. Go out, join these clubs, meet people, as well.
That's important. And also to complement what you're saying, I'll just say that, I don't think there's many people who are going to read a critique of liberalism or a critique of democracy and then want to become, warriors in the cause of the right. I mean, people are inspired by visions of what the future could be, and also for what their own role in the struggle could be. And that's the kind of thing that only art can offer. So I think it's really important that we start to cultivate that more. I would like Arctos to do more creative material along these lines, because I think we're very good at venerating our past, and we should, of course.
Yes,
we should learn from the great masters of the past, of our tradition. But at the same time, we can't just leave it at that and say, okay, we have this great tradition, wasn't it nice? We have to preserve it. We have to continue adding to it. I mean, it's only living and vital if it's continuing to grow and develop. So we, have to step up and start producing artistic works in the Western tradition and I don't mean to slavishly imitate the past either. I mean, we shouldn't be writing in the style of Dostoevsky or Dickens. I mean, we should be exploring new forms, not necessarily doing all the same things that the left is doing, but to not be afraid of experimenting with new things that have never been tried before. I mean, certainly, we all love Wagner now as rightists, but in his day, I mean, Wagner was incredibly revolutionary, and actually conservatives often hated him because it was so different from anything that had come before. So.
Yeah, there were riots at his premieres and things like that.
Yes.
It occurs to me that in addition to what we're doing online and in print, that one thing we can encourage is maybe bring artists together who are within our milieu so they can workshop together.
Yeah, right? This is what I was talking to you the other day about, wasn't it? One of the things that I'll be looking at in the future is having kind of workshops come exhibitions.
Yeah, and the other thing would be exhibitions for visual artists. And it's unfortunate that Charles Kraft last November had a big exhibition in London, and it got shut down by the usual suspects. And it was great, though, that he could go to the London Forum.
Yeah.
That was that around the same time, and show off his stuff and give a speech. And we need to create our own spaces.
Yes.
That's absolutely right. Yeah.
Safe spaces.
Safe spaces.
Although if leftists want to come and be triggered, you know.
I would actually pay to watch some of them get triggered and turn blue. You
know? Yeah. I would like to see Jerry Gable have a heart attack as he looks on, you know, some Charles Kraft exhibits and stuff.
And then Charles could turn his red, then blue face into a teapot someday.
Yeah, that's fun.
Yeah.
But perhaps make his ashes into a nice, nice urn or something.
Yes.
Who'd want to buy it, though?
I'd buy it. Well,
yeah. I think for Jerry Gable, a nice ceramic six-pointed star would probably be the best.
Yeah. Well, David, this has been great. John, thank you as well.
Oh, thank you.
I think this has been a good conversation, and I think it's going to have the desired effect of inspiring some creative acts. So I hope that you'll be joining us again. Both of you will join me again, and that you'll be hearing from some new artists of the right.
Thanks very much for having me.
Thank you.